This is Scott Allen from odecoded.com.
This is Kevin Dente.
This is John Galloway.
This is Scott Coon from lazycoder.com.
Hello, welcome to another episode of Herding Code. This episode is going to be a sort of a smorgasbord episode. We don't have any one big topic to discuss, but we got some good questions and comments from listeners, and there was a few things in the news this week, so we're just going to kind of ruminate on it. We're recording this on Tuesday the 20th, which is, of course, Inauguration Day, and there was some interesting technology stuff happening around the inauguration. One big one was that Microsoft scored the inauguration video streaming on Silverlight, which has got to be a pretty major coup for them. Did you guys get a chance to see the inauguration, and did you watch it on Silverlight?
I saw part of it. There are actually a ton of different sites. I heard later there was I saw Ryan Stewart who works for Adobe saying, well, it's also, you know, there's a Flash based stream, and then there was the big one, pick2009.org, I believe, and that was on Silverlight, and then Vertigo worked on some other sites that had they use that Move player, which is annoying to have to install another player, but it does this really high definition streaming, and it had seven different viewpoints and all that stuff. So I watched it and played with that for a while. That was kind of neat.
I watched a little bit too, and I started on that pick2009 website, and then I moved over to I guess it was one of the CBS websites that you tweeted about, John. Yeah. And I was actually kind of surprised because that started in Silverlight, right? That initially it's all Silverlight.
Yeah, there's a Silverlight player, and then if you want, you can use this additional Move player, which works with Silverlight, and it does this, like, it gives you really good quality. It's a huge pain in the neck to program for. I haven't used it myself, but I've talked to the guys that have worked with it. But it's continually like chopping up the video stream into tiny little 1 second or, you know, 3 second bursts, and it's continually selecting the best one. So the second you start watching, it grabs, you know, a low bit rate and starts playing, and then immediately it starts, you know, adjusting to give you the best one, and it continually gets, you know, moves you back and forth between those streams, depending on the speed. So I think it's probably like about the best you can do video wise as far as bandwidth and quality, but you have to install another player, which is kind of annoying. So
that's what surprised me, because I clicked on the button to say give me the high definition feed, thinking, well, that'll be Silverlight too. Silverlight can do pretty high def video. I was just really shocked to see that I had to install another player, so I canceled out of that and just, but I was wondering what other sites you found interesting today, because I thought there was a number of places that Silverlight was popping up. And the other one, well, the one I thought that was most impressive was CNN Politics, CNN.com. They have a page called The Moment, which is using Photosynth to put together all the pictures that people uploaded of the inauguration. Have you guys seen that?
Yes, I had.
So that's pretty impressive.
Yeah, I looked at it too. It was also, I thought it was very cool. I did tweet my complaints about it though, which is, and I've seen this in a couple of sites that they do the sort of Silverlight deep zoomy kind of thing where when you use the mouse wheel to scroll, or sorry, use the mouse wheel to zoom in and out, when you do it on IE, it works fine. When you do it on Firefox, it zooms in and out, but it also scrolls the page viewport at the same time. So you have this sort of, you're zooming in while your page is hopping up the in the browser window, and it's incredibly irritating. So that was my only annoyance with that whole Photosynth thing. But the actual Photosynth was very cool, and it's very interesting sort of scene to be able to get a different glimpse of.
You can actually see the guys with the sniper rifles on the Capitol building if you go up and look at the upper tier.
Wow. Those are good guys, just, sniper rifles, right?
Yeah, good guys, yeah. But you can zoom in on them. I mean, they don't look like good guys. They're dressed in black. They have masks on, and you know, you can see the tripod sitting there, but I'm, you know, assuming they're good guys. And I just realized I have Silverlight running in Chrome, which I don't remember doing anything special to do that. Does that just work now?
Last I heard, it worked fortuitously. Like it was, they hadn't done anything specific to support it, since it's a regular plugin, you know, Netscape style plugin, it mostly kind of worked.
Sure. Okay.
So another sort of technology news around the inauguration was that they switched over their website, the new whitehouse.gov website. And there was a bit of a buzz about the fact that it was all built on ASP.NET. And of course, you know, all the .NET geeks immediately start disassembling the site, so to speak, like looking at what JavaScript libraries are loaded. Oh, it's running Java, it's jQuery, it's got Ajax. It looks like it's .NET 2.0. No, it's 3.5. I thought that was all kind of amusing.
Yes.
It's like, what does it actually say? Well, nobody cares about that.
It's funny too that, you know, people are like, hey, neat, it's ASP.NET, and then they're like, hey, tons of you know, it's web forms and tons of view state. Oh no, this, you know, this way to get off to a bad start, you know, with the presidency. And it's like, I really don't think that, you know, makes a huge, you know, the tone of the presidency is set by the view state. That is an interesting thing, the confusion with whether it was 2.0 or 3.5, because ASP.NET 3.5 is really just kind of a layer on top of the 2.0 compiler. And so if you look at the, you know, the version, it's going to say 2.0. something or other. And so that was interesting. And then, you know, I was kind of trying to remember how you tell the difference. And somebody else looked and saw that it was running the 3.5 version of the ASP.NET Ajax libraries, in addition to jQuery. And it was actually running the debug version of those, of the ASP.NET Ajax, which is a problem because it doesn't cache any of those, and they're a lot larger, and there's a lot of other problems with it. So during the day, somebody else noticed, oh, they switched off the debug ones, so they're on the ball. So it's pretty funny to have everybody quarterbacking the whitehouse.gov website.
I wonder if somebody's actually listening to Twitter and say, oh, damn it.
Right.
We must have left the bug flag on. There was also a bit of a buzz about the robots.txt on the website, and how the previous administration's robot.txt was had 2,400 lines worth of excludes for search engines, and the new one had zero excludes. So sort of a different philosophy, I guess. So the other big wager that was going on yesterday was, would Twitter survive the inauguration, or would it roll over and croak? I personally I think it's going to roll over and croak crowd. I don't know. How about you guys?
I thought I was going to make it through only because, and maybe it's because I haven't been on Twitter a lot lately. It seems to be quite stable. I haven't actually seen it fail in quite some time myself.
Well, It hasn't completely. I mean, I haven't seen the fail whale in a long time, which is part of the reason. For a long time, I was messing around with FriendFeed because I was just sick of Twitter being offline all the time. But it's gotten really stable as far as not being offline. But the thing I always notice is during something like the Macworld, it just started lagging way behind. So, you know, especially API access, you would you know, tweet something and then see it show up, or other people reply to you like 40 minutes later, you know, but I was surprised, you know, and maybe that says something, but it was way behind during Macworld, up to an hour behind. And then during the inauguration, it kept up just fine. So maybe, I don't know if the tweet volume is lower, you know, now as opposed to Macworld, but.
Yeah, I was pretty impressed. It seemed to hold up better than I thought it would. I actually had some problems connecting to the site at like 7 a.m. I don't know if that was really even related or not, but maybe Macworld gave them some lessons and they tweaked it and were able to keep it running. But it's cool. I mean, that's a pretty major accomplishment. So I think that's pretty awesome.
I think that is just a big, I mean, even like that their failure mode is that they have bigger latency is great. Like that's even, you know, that's a big improvement. As opposed to before, it was just like, you know, the fail whale was just a horrible joke, you know, where they just got behind and it's like, oh, sorry, we don't know how to run a website. Sorry. You know, and now it's like they've, you know, they kind of scale it back. So you still can see the site, you can, and then search.twitter.com, you can still follow things. So it just slows down as opposed to just dying. So that's cool.
Okay. Well, I think that's all we had to say about the inauguration. We had a few questions from people that they gave us on Twitter, so we can kind of rapid fire through some of those. One question that I thought was a pretty good one was from Boo Boo Jeebies, who's I love that Twitter handle. I don't know what it means, but it just is it's a great one. Anyway, this question was, what is the one thing I need to dedicate time to learning this year? So what would you guys say?
Do you want to go first, K. Scott? I'm still thinking.
I was just trying to look up some things. My initial instinct was that a lot of people think, well, we'll have to learn .NET 4.0 or something new along those lines. And my first instinct is always, well, what can you learn that's a little more long-lived? So not maybe look at trying to learn a specific technology, but look at design principles or some fundamentals that you may have missed out on. Buying books on refactoring or design patterns or one of the Robert C. Martin books on agile development. I think last year he just released another book called Clean Code. So, you know, topics like that I think are timeless. You can always learn those things and apply them this year and apply them 5 years from now and should be able to apply them 10 years from now too. But if you did want to look at something technology related, I think it was kind of interesting last year. There was a lot of hype around Ruby at the beginning of the year and a lot of people saying, well, this will be the year where I pick a new language to learn and everyone should learn a new language every year. This is the year, I think, that if you haven't sat down with a dynamic language yet, this would be the year to try out something like Python or Ruby or get to know JavaScript a little better.
I guess I have to pick something. I mean, I guess my initial response is like, just pick something is a big start, you know, I think it's easy to just get overwhelmed by all the things out there and say like, I should be learning MVC and I should be learning all these new Windows 7 technologies and all these other things that, I mean, I think a lot of people never really caught a lot of things in ASP.NET 3.5 and even 2.0 and, I mean, there's just a huge, so it's easy to just kind of look at all that and just go like, I can't do it. But I think just picking one thing is good. I think personally what I would recommend is to pick one or more declarative display technologies. Like if you haven't dug into like the whole semantic HTML thing, I've gone on and on about that before, but I think picking a book like David Shea's Zen of CSS Design, where he goes through CSS Zen Garden and, you know, talks about like designing. I think that's good. And then also, I can't remember offhand, but some good like semantic HTML design books, you know, and just kind of like designing HTML so that it's an actual document and it would make sense if you were just reading it. And I think most of us think like, oh, yeah, I already know HTML. I've been doing that for a long time. But I don't think with the whole back to basics movement and looking at, you know, like really learning object-oriented program and really applying these different things, I think it's a good time to kind of go back and look at, did I really learn the right way to do HTML and CSS? And it's a good time to learn that kind of stuff, too, because things like jQuery, working off selectors, that kind of really makes it so that you can leverage semantic markup a lot more. If you're already really good with semantic markup there, I'd say take a look at XAML-based design. Like I think starting with Silverlight is nice because it's a smaller subset. It's easy to look at WPF and just be completely overwhelmed. It's such a huge framework. if you start with Silverlight, there's less there, and it's in a good spot where you can do quite a bit without having to learn everything. And then that kind of flows naturally into WPF. So I think now's a good time to learn declarative, what do you call it? A declarative display technology.
So I'll throw in my two cents here. This is a tough question, I think, because, well, first, because everybody's sort of has, you know, everybody's current knowledge base is different. So, you know, a lot of people may not have been exposed to inversion of control containers and object relational mappers. And if that's true, then I think, you know, that's like those kinds of technologies are things that you really should be learning about now. But for a lot of people, that stuff's old hat. I agree with K. Scott. Like I tend to be more of a just-in-time learner when it comes to specific technologies. Like I don't like just go off and learn everything about WPF just in order to do it. I used to think that I could do that, but you know, with the breadth of technologies available now you know, there's just so much out there that you just can't go and learn it all. I mean, you kind of have to pick and choose what you're going to learn, and so I kind of learn on demand for specific technologies. But you know, design principles, I agree with K. Scott. You know, solid principles, you know, that stuff will serve you no matter what. If I had to give an answer on the technology front, if you're gonna do rich client development, I think this is the time to start learning WPF. I think I personally would not be putting much investment in, you know, WinForms applications in the future, even if you're doing business applications. I think that's just, you know, the worm is turned on that and we're going toward WPF. It's time to get on that train. If you're doing web apps, you know, it's time to learn MVC. Of course, not everybody will agree with me that. You know, it doesn't have to be ASP.NET MVC, but, you know, I think it's time to learn an MVC framework. Could be FUBU, could be Monorail, could be Ruby on Rails, whatever. So I think that would be my answer. John, do you have something to say?
It's hard not to listen to the whole list of things and go like, oh, yeah, that's probably a good one. Oh, that's a good one. I think one good thing that I thought of while you were talking about with the just-in-time learning is that a good way to, like, it's hard to say, well, you should learn this technology or that technology. I think that a good thing is to pick something outside of your work and apply it. I mean, I think a great way to learn just about anything is to get involved with something, get involved with an open source project, or, you know, teach about something at user group or a code camp or something like that, and actually like do something where you're going to have to demonstrate some knowledge and not just sit there and, you know, write a test app and then say, oh, I guess I played with it a bit. Because I have to say, as far as any new technologies where I've thought like, oh, I should learn this and I've played with it, I don't really learn it unless I have to do something public with it. I don't know if that makes any sense. I'm sorry.
I totally agree. I'm living that right now. I've, you know, just recently started contributing to the Witty project, and you know, it's been a WPF learning process for me. I didn't go in like, you know, knowing, I knew a little bit about WPF, but you know, I've been learning as I go, and you know, what better place to make all your mistakes and on somebody else's open source project. That's my philosophy. that's a joke.
Well, I think it's great because it's, you know, it's like the only real code that you know has any use is code that other people are using. And so I think that's kind of a shortcut for like, well, you know, my boss won't let me write WPF apps. Well, fine, you know, here's one that you can work on and, you know, thousands of people are using, or, you know, and there's different things you can do like that, where you can immediately get some real production experience.
Okay, so another question we had was sort of a request to give a comparison of rich client versus RHEA versus web app development, you know, and how your approach is different on those different kinds of development projects. K. Scott, I know you've been working on all three of those. recently, so you might have some insights there.
Sure, yeah, I've done some. I mostly still do web development, but in the course of web development now, I've snuck in a few Silverlight projects here and there that haven't been too substantial, but my Silverlight development experience hasn't been 100% gratifying. I've still experienced a lot of issues with just some friction in getting Silverlight into a build and getting, makes the solution a little more cumbersome. It takes a longer to build. And then deployment has been a bit of an issue this year. We are still trying to work out some things. We're essentially trying to put together a shrink-wrapped web application to sell to hospitals. And the hospital environments are so radically different, just the way they configure their hardware and what software they're running. And it just seems like our installer, we haven't quite gotten everything in there to make for a perfect Silverlight installation as yet. There's either an issue, first it was the MIME type mapping, so that was kind of easy to take care of. Then there was always some communication issues between Silverlight and a WCF service it was calling. But I guess that's one of the biggest things about Silverlight development is that it's a very rich environment, and you get to program in C#, and you have a lot of the base class library stuff in there. But it still sometimes amazes me how primitive it can feel because you're not going to be using an object relational mapper. It wasn't until recently that some of the dependency injection tools started working in Silverlight. And so there's still a few rough edges around that for me. Whereas when I'm in a web project or working on web pages, that's a very comfortable environment for me, and I kind of know it in and out, and it does have a much different feel to it than Silverlight, and part of that's because you do have access to ADO.NET, and you can use an object relational mapper for persistence, and you don't have to worry about devising WCF web services to push state around back somewhere where it can be persisted. And so the patterns are a little bit different. And I've done some MVC work, but a lot of my work is still with web forms, which a lot of people cringe at, but I've been pretty comfortable there over the last couple of years. I think I found something that works. It's been mostly, if we want to talk about design patterns, it's mostly a model view presenter design pattern. I've been able to get testable, maintainable code with that using regular web forms and cutting out view state and basically trying to eliminate the idea of the stateful web form. So I'm trying to take web forms, but I twist it a little bit to, treat it for what it is, which is basically a way to build up HTML and push that down to a client's browser. But recently, I also picked up a WPF application, and this wasn't for real production work. This was just something I was fiddling around with at home, and I guess I'm one of the few people that actually learned Silverlight first and then came in as WPF, although maybe John, you did the same thing.
Yeah.
And I found it to be, in a way, a much more comfortable environment. I was familiar with the XAML. I knew how to do quite a bit with the XAML. The one thing I do miss in WPF is the Visual State Manager that's in Silverlight. So little things like that would catch me off guard. But I built a WPF application using Prism from Microsoft Patterns and Practices, which is a way to build a composite smart client application. So it has the concept of putting together of breaking your application down into a number of modules, and each module can plug in a piece of the UI. And you can communicate in modules using an eventing system that they put together. So they have an event aggregator, which I found to be quite nice. So I can have one module raise an event that say, the user requested such and such an action that can be handled somewhere else in a module that was written to not – the two modules weren't written to know about each other at all. They're completely decoupled, but one publishes an event that the other one is listening for. So that works quite well, and that's something that I'd like to take back now and apply to Silverlight in the future, and now that I've learned how to use that. I don't think it's really applicable in web applications as much, being a – since it's such a stateless environment. Yeah, so the interesting thing about the WPF application is that I had worked previously with the PNP's composite web application guidance, which I don't remember what the name was they had for that particular package. But the concepts are very similar, just breaking an application into modules, and each module can expose some services, it can expose some UI pieces. But when you're building a web application using PNP guidance, if you're building a composite web application, then their basic pattern behind the scenes, behind a specific piece of the user interface, is a model view presenter pattern. Whereas in WPF, it is this new model view model pattern, which when I first looked at it, I thought that just sounds like a big ball of mud. But actually, after working with it a bit, I got pretty comfortable with it. And I think it works pretty well, partly because my initial intention was just to go with what I know, which is more of the traditional model view presenter pattern. But the model view model is actually nice because of the way that you can route commands from XAML into your view model. And also, I like the concept of taking your view model and making it essentially the bindable data source for your view. So you simply inject that view model into the view and set it as the data context, and then everything in XAML can reference the properties on that view model. Which I guess the only irritating part to me is the fact that a typo in the XAML isn't going to get caught until you have some sort of test that uses UI automation to find that. So that's the one irritating thing to me still, is the binding syntax in XAML.
So, yeah, I've done some work with all of these over the past year in different capacities. I think most of the work has been, like you were saying, Scott, was with web forms. And when I was doing that, the majority of the work, I've really gone to not using the controls very much at all, and to using the list view and just, you know, writing out as much as possible, just writing out HTML, standard HTML.
Right.
So, I mean, that's been interesting, and I've been trying to, you know, kind of perfect that some, but as I was working on it, I was like, okay, this may be the last ASP.NET web form site I ever write, which would be okay. And then, I've done a lot of work with Silverlight lately, and that's been interesting as far as one thing you mentioned was the whole thing of the complications. It's a tricky environment because you're really working in several different tiers. Like you have a plugin that's running inside the browser, which then is making callbacks to a web server, and then the web server may hit a database, and it gets even more complicated if you've got your plugin running in the browser, which is calling out to another website, and you've got cross-domain issues, and there's just a lot of things that, you know, you may hit a little bit with JavaScript, but they just get really complex, the whole model of like, well, where am I right now, you know, and what do I have access to? I think that's gotten simpler a little bit over, you know, with each release, but it still can be, I think that's probably one of the hardest things, especially when you're getting started with it. And then the WPF work I've been doing has been on this Witty project. And that partly was just because I felt like it was partly because I wanted to learn WPF better, and partly because I was on Twitter all the time and just wanted to be able to add features and change it as I went. And I'm not sure if I can really say anything that, production experience wise on WPF, other than that MVVM model has been great in Silverlight and I think could be really helpful in WPF as well. I believe that's where it came from first. It was in WPF and then started bleeding over into Silverlight. But I think that really simplifies the whole development model quite a bit, because it's very easy with WPF or with Silverlight to fall back into the pattern of, you know, you've got a control on the page, and then you've got a click event, and then in the click event, you write some code that sets some properties on other controls, which is, you know, a total anti-pattern, but it's the easiest, it's a path of least resistance, especially when you're working with a new technology. And the MVVM pattern just lets you write clean models, and then you write your view model, which translates those into something bindable. And then you just bind to it. And it's cleaner in WPF because you've got the command pattern, which you don't really have in Silverlight. But I think that's been really cool to see that, and that's simplified those developing in both those technologies lately for me. I guess then the other, another thing to compare these all is deployment. We've been deploying Witty via ClickOnce, and that's still really tricky to make a good. I think ClickOnce feels like something that it's a neat technology, but I don't really see any ClickOnce apps coming out of Microsoft, and I get that feeling when working with ClickOnce deployment that it's like it's neat, but it doesn't seem like it's really been all the scenarios have been tested out, and that it's really being put through its paces.
Why do you think that is? I've been kind of curious about that, because when I first heard about ClickOnce, it sounded pretty awesome, but it just has not had a whole lot of uptake.
I don't know at all. I mean, I know from the point of view of a developer working with it that there's some frustrating limitations with it. And they're the kind of things that I would figure that, okay, as the Microsoft team start publishing things with this, they're going to run into these same things and they'll fix them. And I don't know if anybody in Microsoft is really doing that. I mean, other than, the product team that's working on that feature. And I think another huge thing, and I keep bugging anybody I talk to that works with CodePlex about this, but I keep saying, can you guys please support ClickOnce? Because I think that would be great for an open source project to eliminate the whole distribution issue. It would really get a lot more developers and a lot more end users working with ClickOnce. And I think it would also, by having more use, would get some of these bugs raised, as like people might put more effort into that. But I don't know. It's a neat technology. It's great when it works, and then it's just frustrating when there's things that you can't do with it, or in order to do are a pain in the neck.
Maybe we should have Brian Noyes on sometime and talk to him. He wrote a whole book on ClickOnce.
Yeah.
The only Microsoft product I can think of that uses it is with SQL Server reporting services. You can download a ClickOnce application that's an ad hoc report designer.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
But I can't think of anything else that I've ever seen use it.
Which really, I mean, that should be something where like all these, they have so many different little power toys and little tools and things that you can download, and with all of them they all have their own way of distributing, or you run an MSI or whatever, but those really all should be ClickOnce, I think.
Right. Well, I was thinking something like Windows Live Writer.
Right. Yeah.
Why couldn't that be ClickOnce?
Go ahead.
I haven't looked at the Click stuff once stuff in a while, not since it first came out, but I recall having this sort of distinct impression that they were targeting the enterprise application space, like the custom application, written by your IT department, and that they didn't really flesh out the, sort of external distribution sort of scenario nearly as much.
Yeah, interesting. That could be, yeah. Except the enterprise has always had things like group policies and domain controllers and Microsoft operation managers and all that stuff to push out updates and applications.
Right.
So they just, I don't know.
One group that's not using ClickOnce at all, but really has a nice deployment technology is the sysinternals. All the sysinternals tools, a lot of them will run via, you can just do whack live.sysinternals.com. /zoomit.exe and it'll just run. And that's really slick. And so I don't scurry around like keeping backups of all those anymore. I just run them directly off of there. But I would love to see more of that too, like Windows Live Writer and that kind of thing. They have a decent installer, but it could be better. So, and it would be nice if there was somebody inside Microsoft using Click Once and maybe some of the bugs that we hit and you know, challenges and things would go away.
The System Journals guys have it nailed. It's not click once, it's click zero times. It's like
right,
uber easy.
You do have to click the end user license agreement, but that's tiny. So,
do we have a Coon Man on the call here? Okay, but hang on, let me do a cut in intro here. Ladies and gentlemen, just in. We have none other than Mr. Scott Coon joining us here mid-recording. For those of you who haven't heard, Scott's been on quote-unquote paternity leave from the podcast. So it's good to have you back, Scott. How's it going?
I'll let you know in another couple of months.
When you've actually had a chance to sleep?
Yeah. Yeah, I'm basically on baby duty from 8-ish until midnight-ish. So I feed her last bottle around 11, and then hopefully she goes to sleep and stays asleep until 3 or so when Mama can feed her again.
And so you're making use of all the technologies available, like Benadryl in the baby bottle, that kind of thing?
Not yet. Although I'm loading her up on that formula and she sleeps better.
I think the Benadryl is for you.
Right.
No,
right.
The beer is for me. It just comes in a different bottle. Other than that, she's just perfect. And even that's not too bad. 20, 25 minutes and usually she's down.
Well, congratulations on the new arrival. Not so new anymore, I guess, but...
I just read a tweet from someone else. It's almost time to feed my bottle. Feed my son a bottle. Okay. All right, moving on. What are we talking about?
Oh, we just wrapped up with jQuery.
Yeah. Oh, my God. We just finished our JavaScript show.
Oh, well. jQuery's old and busted now. We're moving on to the new hotness.
Which would be?
Now that Microsoft is using jQuery, it's passe.
MooTools for the win.
Yeah, well, I'm thinking we'll move on to Dojo because that's much more enterprisey. We'll wait for we'll try to steer Microsoft towards acquiring them, and then we can go back to using our wonderful jQuery.
I just want to leech information off you, but what's the whole jQuery 1.3? Is it exciting?
Yes. Lots of performance increases. And there's a lot of refactoring in the jQuery UI section. Makes things much cleaner. There are a lot of breaking changes, unfortunately. But the new selector engine, Sizzle, in jQuery 1.3, nice. Very fast. We kind of did some preliminary testing of 1.3 on one of our apps at work, and we were seeing anywhere from an 18 to a 60% increase in performance in terms of speed and parts of the app. There were some things that broke, but it's just for file copy upgrades to 1.3. That's not too
broke,
bad.
At least they broke really fast, right?
Yeah. Broke fast, and I don't think the fixes are going to be all that hard to go in and get it upgraded. But yeah, the thing that I thought was interesting was that 1.3 apparently broke IntelliSense on Visual Studio, when we had just gotten it. So there's apparently a hack out there to get it running or something to get it working. But it'll be interesting to see if Microsoft can keep pace, I guess. Or I guess they put most of that back on the jQuery folks, didn't they? To keep that file definition up to date. Did I get dropped?
No.
No, no, you're still here.
We just don't know.
No. Just don't know.
Yeah, I didn't hear whether who owned that process at this point. But mm-hmm. Makes sense that it was the jQuery guys. But
well, I know it's in their repository.
Right.
Oh, here's an interesting post. Does your IDE define you or support you?
My IDE completes me.
My IDE just sits there and takes up RAM.
Okay, so where were we?
I guess we'd done the Obama inauguration, whatever. I was trying to be slick about right. that. And we talked about the comparison of client RIA and web apps. And then I think, we talked about what's the one thing I need to learn this year.
What is the one thing you need to learn this year? I don't know what I want to learn. There's too many things I want to learn this year.
What's the top of the list?
I think I want to really, really learn and understand expressions in Link. Because, you know, all the typical MSDN examples are, you know, select this from, you know, object list where, you know, blah, blah, blah. But whenever I see people, you know, writing either frameworks or you know, production code, they're mostly dealing with like expression trees and defining their own things, and I want to see what all that's about. I don't really understand all of that and really what's going on there.
That would be good to learn. I found them quite useful outside of just using them in Link queries. So I've used expression trees or expression of T, that type. I've used that to replace reflection code in a lot of places. So instead of having reflection code that's trying to go through or where you might specify something with a string literal, so you specify a property name, I use an expression instead because you can still get that string literal that you need as a parameter to the reflection code from the expression tree. But because you wrote it as an expression tree, it's still compiled code where you're saying object dot and some property. So if you typo the property, you get a compiler error. And then also all of your refactoring operations work. So if I go in and I change a property name, the code that's inside my expression of T will be updated. And then all the reflection stuff still works, which is awesome. And I think that's one of the primary uses I've seen of expression trees outside of the Link context. Use it for things like object-to-object mapping and just basically replacing reflection code. The mocking frameworks of Casalino's mock framework uses expression trees in an interesting way too, which is basically to specify the expectations on your mock using expression trees.
Yeah, that's exactly what I was going to say, is that like not only is it a good time to learn it for your own code, but more and more the frameworks are all taking advantage of that. So like mock does that. I believe, you know, some of the other mocking frameworks have followed suit. I think RhinoMox does now.
Yeah, RhinoMox has its version of that.
And then like we were talking to the guys about FUBU MVC, and they were using that. Structure Map is making use of that. I know that Subsonic is making more use of that. So I think that that's something where, you know, from a framework writer point of view, that's a big deal. And so then it's helpful as a user. You need to understand how to create an expression or to work with expressions to use those frameworks. So I agree, that's something I need to get better with.
Yeah, just on that general topic of Link, like I do feel like I need to, like I've used Link and I kind of get Link, but it's not like embedded in my DNA yet. You know, like I don't think in Link yet. I think at some point you need to like make that jump, and then, you know, Link, the sort of Linky way of doing things becomes the default way of thinking. And I personally haven't made that transition yet. I hopefully I'll be able to make that transition soon.
Most places, at least. Most of the places I've seen and most people I've talked to have worked at aren't using .NET 3.5 yet. And so they're still stuck in 2.0. they are linkless. So that's one of the reasons that I haven't had the opportunity to use link and expressions and things like that, is because I just don't, you know, unless I do it in my spare time and learn it, which is what I plan on doing this year, is, you know, I just don't get a chance to work with it at work. You know, we're using generics heavily, and even, you know, we're starting to use lambdas in some of our unit tests, because our unit tests are using 3.5, ironically. but we haven't migrated our production code, our main application code, to that. And even Witty, you know, I thought, hey, this would be a great place to use link, because all we've got is we've got this collection of objects, which are tweets, and it'd be great to be able to sort and filter and find and whatever else on that. But even Witty is only targeting .NET 3.0, and so we can't use all the 3.5 goodness yet.
I think we should just say screw it and do it, because, you know, it's an open sourcey project, and you can just kind of make decisions like that. And I think it would, you know, 3.5 has been out for a long time. I'm not sure if part of the reason, I'm not sure exactly why, you know, it hasn't been upgraded to, or, you know, hasn't required 3.5.
Yeah, I totally agree. I feel like, what, you know, in an open source project where people are donating their free time, you know, to developing it, like, anything you can do to make those people more productive is, you know, you should do, because, you know, they're being generous with their time.
Well, and also, like you're saying, I mean, a big motivation of doing an open source project is a chance to escape the drudgery and confines of your work, you know, and to work on something and use technologies you'd really like to use. So, I mean, that's a perfect example of that. But earlier you were saying that, you know, most companies are not up, you know, are still on, are on 2.0, haven't moved to 3.5 yet. And I'm just wondering what the, you know, what you think the main reasons for are with that, because, I mean, 3.5 in just about all cases should be like a, you know, pretty painless upgrade. There aren't really a lot of breaking changes that I'm aware of.
I think there were in terms of ASP.NET, in terms of the base class library. I don't think there were, but it just seems like from what am I trying to say here? 1.1 to 2 was a pretty big leap, and then 2 to 3.5 is a pretty big leap in terms of ASP.NET. And you know, so installing a new, at least in our case, since we provide a hosted solution and also an installable solution, us moving to 3.5 means that our customers may have to move to 3.5, which means the IT departments have to vet, you know, 3.5 and get it installed on their systems, you know, on their production servers, maybe multiple data centers, depending on how big their installation is. So, and there may not have been too many breaking changes from ASP.NET 2.0 to 3.5, but I know it's not as simple as just, you know, flipping a switch and recompiling. At least it hasn't seemed like it to me. We've gotten a lot of, you know, there's been some times when I've flipped it over and I've seen a lot of compiler errors and things like that. But, you know, that could just be ramblings of a fragmented mind, mainly mine.
Well, I mean, that point that you bring up about requiring end users to upgrade their servers, I mean, that's a valid point. It's not just that it's an internal application, but it, you know, is going to decrease or I mean, it's going to decrease sales potentially. Then that's an issue.
Well, and you know how sketchy sysadmins are about what goes on their precious servers.
Right. They want to be running the oldest. They want the oldest operating systems possible, which have the most leaks and published vulnerabilities and all that.
Yes. Well, and well, no, they're not old. They're well tested.
Right.
Yeah, my take on 3.5 is that from what I've seen, of course, you do always have the resistance to change that's inside of an organization. So you have to vet things through the IT department, and then you have to worry about getting all the workstations upgraded with new versions of Visual Studio and so forth. But if you look at the transition from 1.1 to 2.0, there were some pretty compelling features that people would look at and say, I need to move to that as quickly as possible. So generics were one example of something in the language where people could look at and instantly see a benefit. And if you look at the transition from ASP.NET 1.1 to 2.0, well, initially there was a big problem, which was the fact that the web application support wasn't there, and they switched over the compilation model to the website model, which enraged a lot of people. But once that got worked out, then all that new stuff in ASP.NET 2.0 is available. So all sorts of new controls and object data sources and so forth that people want to use. But if you look at 2.0 to 3.5, if you're looking at something like ASP.NET, there were new things, but it pales in comparison to the 2.0, from the 1.1 to 2.0 transition. So there just wasn't anything huge in ASP.NET. You know, they brought together AJAX and ASP.NET, so it was finally released as at the same time, and they started supporting WCF web services, but nothing there that was really big pieces of functionality that were new until Service Pack 1 came out, and they had the whole dynamic data thing, which I think a lot of people still look at with suspicion. And then if you look at on the language and runtime side, you look at the new features in C#, well, most people will look at it and say that the new thing in C# was link and expression trees and lambda expressions. But a lot of people will look at link and say that's for querying databases. It's not something I need, not realizing that link to objects itself can be pretty powerful. And if you look at the applications of link that shipped, link to XML, that API is pretty compelling. But again, it's not something that you need right away if you already have stuff working with the XML document. And then link to SQL and the entity framework both had their issues. So, you know, a lot of people didn't have a burning desire to jump into those right away. And, you know, the entity framework actually wasn't released until Service Pack 1 came out.
Yeah, I'm also in the, you know, in the enterprise software space, and we are just now in our next version upgrading to 3.5. And you know, part of it is that you know, when you work on a big product that has long release cycles, like if your release cycle doesn't line up with Microsoft's release cycle and you miss it by a little bit, then it's going to be a significant amount of time before you have a chance to go around again and sort of catch up. And if there isn't something like really compelling or a compelling reason to do that, then you know, working on new features that are going to win you new business may take priority over, you know, converting everything to a new version of the framework. Now, that being said, I mean, there are some great features in 3.5, and you know, we want to be able to take advantage of them. But even some of the new features, well, if you've got a big existing architecture, you know, you're not going to like throw away all your database access and switch it all to link to SQL now. So the opportunity to sort of roll in those new features may not present itself for some time. So, you know, it's definitely it's not just a case in our case, it's not just a case of, you know, we don't want to learn new stuff, or, you know, we want to stay on the old stuff because it's a pain to upgrade. You know, there's definite sort of migration issues that can be a barrier to that.
Yeah, I guess that makes a lot of sense. I was looking at this point as not thinking of the point of view of actually, you know, like shipping software that customers are going to buy and install. I mean, it's yeah, and I guess that points out my, you know, I'm thinking from the point of view of like if you're building a website and you're hosting the website, there are a lot fewer reasons to fight an upgrade, but if you're actually building a package product, then it makes more sense to sit on it. I'm going to cut that out.
It makes you sound a little academian.
Well, what I was trying to say was that, like, if you're building a lot of people build and host their own websites, right? And it's a web application, and like Google can roll a new version of Google out every 2 days, and you know, I mean, it's no big deal. So they could, you can implement the newest version of any framework you want, and it's not the biggest deal. You just deploy it to your servers. But if you're actually shipping code off that other people are going to install on their servers or their desktops, then that's, you know, then you do have to worry more about legacy support and all that.
And that was one of the things that I worried about with just flipping the switch on Witty was, you know, we've kind of got click once support out there, but we don't really have a host for it, and it's not really updated. And if we do put that in, can we, you know, make sure to update the click once so that it includes the client profile and at least installs, you know, enough to get moving? And will Witty run with just the client profile, or does it require some more stuff? And blah, blah, blah.
This call requires a coin deposit. Please hang up momentarily, then redial your call by first depositing the local rate posted on the instruction card, or dial 0 for the operator.
All right, that's it for another episode of Herding Code. Hope you can join us next time.